That's our theme music from Joe Cocker called Respect Yourself, with some great messages about respecting yourself and others. I'm technician Declan Curran in the absence of Sheldon Brown, who's having some surgery today. And this is Mental Health Radio, taken from us, brought to you and funded by Framework Trust. In Sheldon's absence, we've selected two edited interviews from last year. The first involves the author of two memoirs, Lotta Dan. The memoir we talked to Lotta about today is called Mrs. D is Going Within. Lotta discovered that her lifelong heavy drinking had left her as a fledgling emotionally with bouts of niggling anxiety and unease. Here's Lotta to tell us her challenges to find practices to help her emotional strength and what going within really means.
Memoir we talked to Lotta about today is called Mrs. D is Going Within. Lotta discovered that her lifelong heavy drinking had left her as a fledgling emotionally with bouts of niggling anxiety and unease. So here's Lotta to tell us what going within really means. Welcome, Lotta, back to Take It From Us.
Hi, great to be here.
Wonder what sort of symptoms of dis-ease or anxiety were you experiencing? Well, I suppose it's you've written this book. It's probably nearly 12 months ago that these symptoms started to arrive, or even earlier perhaps.
Yeah, I probably started noticing about 2 or 3 years after I quit drinking. You know, initially when I took alcohol out of my life, that was so much of a focus for me, and just learning how to not drink, it really dominated my experience. And after about 2 or 3 years of being sober, when sober became ordinary, which is a wonderful thing, right? I wasn't fighting to not drink every day. I just didn't drink, and that was my norm. That was great. But then what I started noticing was this other stuff that was going on for me. And, you know, when you're sober all the time and raw, there's really no escaping how you're feeling. And I just wasn't feeling great. And I feel almost bad admitting that, because I always want to promote being sober because it is amazing and I love it and it's so much better than being boozy. But the truth is, you know, when you take alcohol away, you really discover what's underneath. And for me, yeah, there was definitely... I'd call it a low-grade anxiety. I'd often find myself almost with a nervous tummy, like something was wrong, and I'd be thinking, you know, why am I nervous? Have I got something to do later today, or have I just received an email I'm worried about? And I'd sort of try and figure out, and there wasn't anything specific. I just felt edgy, and I started realizing I needed to do something about that.
Did you feel that your mental health was, threatened or impacted?
Yeah, well, yes, because I felt, you know, uncomfortable. I wasn't just cruising through my days. I was fraught, and I had this, you know, physical sensation of nerves and butterflies in my tummy, tightening in my chest. I mean, all of that is your mental health, isn't it? I mean, I don't want to over-exaggerate it, because in general I don't suffer from any major anxiety or depression or anything like that. I mean, I don't. But I have a low-grade sense often of being just wound up, you know, and I was just, like I say, I became very aware of that because I was sober, number one, and number two, I wasn't putting so much energy into not drinking. So I just found I got to a point where it was like, I need to do some further work on myself, you know.
Do you think that this, I mean, we described in the introduction that you sort of may have discovered that you were emotionally a fledgling, if you like, that was the impact of the alcohol, and you had to grow up emotionally. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and, you know, what was also happening as I spent more time being sober is that things were happening in my life that were hard. You know, I had my beloved stepfather died. That was terrible grief. Stresses through work, you know, just stuff happening around me. And as those things occurred, especially the big things, I just really realized I was very ill-equipped to deal with them. I had no strategies You know, my go-to strategy had always been to have a drink. I mean, that's what I did. I always had a wine, and that is a strategy. It's not a particularly healthy one, but it worked for me for 20-plus years until I stopped drinking. And so, yeah, I just found I was ill-equipped emotionally to manage myself through these difficult things. And that's why I got to this point where I was like, I need to do some more work. I'm struggling here. I'm floundering around. I'm sober, and that's great. But now I need to do some more work.
Yeah, I mean, I've read the book Mrs. D is Going Within, and there's occasions when I read pages where I almost thought that you were tempted to go back to the drink.
No, I don't think I've ever been properly tempted to go back to drink. I really don't, to be honest with you. I think I love having alcohol out of my life. I look at alcohol now as just this stupid, you know, substance. I understand why so many of us drink, because it does work, but it's so destructive and dysfunctional, really, as a coping mechanism, and I feel quite detached from it. I'm happy to have it out of my life. I don't want to go back to where I was at all. But I did have other coping mechanisms that were unhealthy, particularly food, sugar, and flour.
Flour?
I can be very alcoholic in my relation to those foods.
Oh,
yeah.
Flour.
And I've just been reading a book, a really interesting book about the brain, which sets out, you know, very clearly the science behind the fact that flour and sugar impact on the brain in the same way as alcohol and cocaine, because they've been so refined down from their original
product.
State.
Yeah.
So, I can crave ciabatta rolls and have three in a sitting. I mean, we're not talking about healthy food. We're talking about, you know, quite alcoholic behaviours.
Right.
And this was the other thing I was noticing, along with my discomfort and butterflies and tightening in my chest and, you know, feeling a bit anxious, was also that I was really reaching for and acting in the same way as I was when I was drinking with these foods, and having the same guilt and the same cravings. And I just was really stuck and needed to...
Did you classify those as addictions, do you think, or...
I'm still working on it now. And when I wrote this last book, I was binging on sugary, flowery foods throughout. I have to be honest.
To meet the deadline of producing the memoir.
Exactly. I mean, how ironic is that? Here I was writing about how I'm working on my mental health, and I was still acting at the same time in a very unhealthy way. But I'm honest about that in the book. I mean, I'm always honest about it, because I never want to purport to be this perfect example of how to sort yourself out. But
I think you're exceedingly honest in this book, and that's one of the wonderful aspects of it. How about your self-esteem and self-image, I guess, while you were writing this memoir, Mrs. D is Going Within, but also, I guess, on your, well, I suppose you'd call it a path to self-discovery, to discovering strategies and wellness tools that were going to help this unease that you had.
Yeah, I mean, I exposed myself very greatly in the book, and that was uncomfortable for me to write and to put out. And I don't know why I'm driven to be so honest, but I am. And so there was this one part of me that was driven to kind of be brutally honest and write it out, and I was doing that. But at the same time, I was feeling very exposed and raw and vulnerable about that, and coping with those feelings by having unhealthy behaviours, self-sabotaging behaviours.
Right, but isn't honesty the only really effective approach to wellness?
Yeah, I do believe so, absolutely. And even just talking honestly now, you know, it always helps me, and I think people obviously relate to that. But there is I'd be lying if I didn't say I pay a price, because I can be left feeling very vulnerable, and when I feel that kind of strong emotion, I self-sabotage. This is what I still need to work on, is not moving to behaviours that are self-sabotaging when I'm feeling very uncomfortable in my own skin. I mean, and it sounds funny because no one made me write this book, right? It was my choice.
Well, but, you'd written one with the title Mrs. D is Going Without, and once you adopted some of these strategies that we're going to talk about, it was natural, surely, to write
a follow-up,
a second in the series, yes. Well, let's get on to some of those strategies that, you played around with a little bit, didn't you? And then suddenly you started to realise the benefits. What were some of those strategies that you relate to in the heading of this book or the title of the book about going within yourself?
Well, I've been hearing, I spend a bit of time on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, and I kept hearing all these other wellness people talking about things like yoga and gratitude and mindfulness. And to be honest with you, I'd always been very resistant. I thought it was wishy-washy, claptrap, monks on mountaintops, not for me. But I got to this point where I was feeling so uncomfortable. I knew I was having these other unhealthy behaviours around food. And so I just thought, right, I'm going to try these things. Bugger it, let's just see. What are they? How do they work in practical terms? Because I'm always very practical. Like, I want, practically speaking, how's this going to impact on my days? I'm going to research them, basically. And so I set about. And as you know, if you've read the book, there was a lot of trial and error. I would try different kind of meditation teachers like Deepak Chopra, or I'd go to a yoga class and I'd hate it. There was a lot of no, and thankfully I didn't give up. And one of the things I really hope that people do get out of the book is the sense that if you try one or two things and they don't work, don't give up. There's so much available out there, different classes you can go to, different people you can listen to online. Keep going until you find the ones that fit with you. And eventually I did, and I did, after three goes, found the yoga class that worked for me, and now I've gone from hating yoga to absolutely loving it. I mean, last night I was really stressed and grumpy, and I went to my yoga class, when I came out of it, I felt more relaxed and positive. I mean, it was that tangible in 1 hour from doing yoga. I don't know. Why exactly, but it works.
Well, it's wonderful to get that reward from just an hour's effort, isn't it? I do what's called a Sunday Restore yoga session once a month, and that's actually 2.5 hours, and it's not about standing on your head or doing anything sort of athletic. It's very much about just relaxing into a pose, which normally is lying down and putting your thigh and your leg on a support and then breathing, and I come out of there. Well, I do come out absolutely zen-like.
I know.
And then I get back into Auckland's traffic, and by the time I get home.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, life keeps going on, and the other big thing that I researched is mindfulness, and just really starting, it unlocked for me this real understanding of my brain and my thought patterns and how it works and how lost I get in my thinking, and just having the ability to identify what you're doing. And with something like yoga, it just forces you to break out of those patterns for a while, which can be so relaxing, because we spend a lot of time thinking, don't we?
Well, we do, and it's managing that thinking. And I think mindfulness is a brilliant tool, wellness tool, but you really, I think, would it be fair to say that you got a bit lucky with mindfulness? You went online and you were very impressed with a couple of practitioners.
Yeah, I mean, I tried Deepak Chopra and Oprah's website. That didn't work for me. And then I tried an app called Headspace, which is hugely popular, but it wasn't right for me. And then I stumbled upon a book, which someone, I think, recommended to me through my blog. And I got it out of the library. And then it was an 8-week plan, so quite early on I stumbled onto this book and I followed their plan to the letter for 8 weeks, and that really unlocked it for me. Only by really forcing myself to do it for the 8 weeks every day, you know, as instructed, did I start actually understanding what the concepts were and what impact they could have, practically speaking, on my days.
Well, you had a few challenges, though, with three boys, is it, under 12, and busy yeah. household, and having to get up and surreptitiously sort of lean against the sofa.
Well, that's right. But, you know, the main thing, I think, to realise with mindfulness is it's very subtle. And it's very slow burning. And it, you know, and for someone like me who's an alcoholic, who's used to kind of quick, fast, you know, let's just fix this or let's just, you know, make it hard and fast, to have to kind of slow yourself and get into it and then slowly start to see the benefits, it's a real adjustment. But once, you know, I'd made that adjustment and I started seeing these little impacts, that I really start getting it. And I mean, I'm still a huge work in progress, really. Still got a long way to go. But the fact that I've got the concepts now and I can use it, and sometimes I need to use it more than others.
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know? And we're talking to Lotta Dan, who I think we can rightfully describe as an author and writer, but also a blogger and somebody that knows a lot about the gains of becoming sober and sobriety. That's a fair description, Lotta?
Yes, that is a fair description.
Right. Well, we were talking about the slow burn effect of mindfulness, and I guess in my practice of mindfulness, as I do it more regularly, then the benefits become, I guess, more clear-cut.
Yeah, and I think the word regularly is the key here in the word practice, because it's not something you read a book and then you get it and then you have it. It is something you need to practice daily if you can, because then you can start changing the patterns of your mind. And it's, you know, I think I've said this to you before, but it's quite hard to articulate. You can describe what it is and you can hear someone describe it, but until you start actually doing it yourself and seeing the little subtle difference it can make to your whole experience of life, then you can really appreciate. I mean, if anyone's listening who hasn't tried it, I heartily recommend you give it a go for a week, say, where you find a book or a podcast and you just try and practice it, and you'll slowly start to see that you have this ability to recognize what you're thinking about and just disengage from the thoughts, even just for a second. Thank you, brain, for worrying about that email. Now, if you don't mind, I'm just going to feel the water on my hands as I wash these dishes. I mean, it sounds like nothing, but if you just do that occasionally, you start to disengage and not get so caught up in thinking, which can lead us to all manner of, you know, disease.
Well, put simply, I mean, with that example where you just focus on the water on your hands as you do the dishes, I mean, you're living in the present, aren't you? You're focusing on the thing that you are doing, and mindfulness is often, you know, recommends that that's how we live our life.
Yeah, and because, you know, difficult things happen, right? Emails are sent that are concerning and worrying. So you get the email, it's concerning and worrying, you have to deal with it. Now, you feel some disease when you get the email, right? And then, but if you spend the next 3 or 4 hours worrying and fretting and thinking about that email, then it's really bled into your day hugely, right? And then you have to reply to the email. So you can choose whether or not to spend those 3 or 4 hours in between receiving and then replying to the email. You can choose whether or not you spend all of that time being very sort of tightly wound thinking about it, or whether you can try and have snatches of time within that where you don't. And if you can do the latter and break out of the worry, it creates a more calm experience, and it makes you better in a better to actually deal with it when you need to. Does that make sense? I'm sorry, I feel like that was a bit convoluted.
Well, it certainly makes sense to me, but you have admitted that there's a sort of fairly significant development which is stressing you out right at the moment. I mean, without necessarily going into the detail of that, how is your mindfulness helping you through this?
Yeah, so right now I'm in the middle of a, what I would describe as quite a difficult situation for me, and it's an emotional situation. It's not something I have a lot of control over. I'm trying to manage my way through it as best I can. But it's stressing me out, it is. And I'm aware of the fact that I am thinking about it a lot. I'm creating imaginary conversations in my mind with people that don't even... They're not even aware they're fighting with me in my mind. I'm creating the fight.
What?
And,
God, they're a bloody nuisance, those imaginary conversations, aren't they?
Yeah, so this is a really difficult situation for me. It's quite extreme. And now that I'm aware of it, you know, I've got mindfulness as a tool. I'm aware of how it works. I'm very aware of how my mind works. I can see, it's almost like I've got a little observer standing back who can see me being fixated on this. And that little observer in my mind is just pulling me up constantly. You know, you stop thinking about this now. You're having a shower. Think about the shower. Stop, you know, worrying about this now. You're cooking dinner. Think about the mince. I mean, again, it sounds like nothing much, but I think it is helping me, definitely, this mindfulness, because I'm just able to have moments where I'm relaxing myself. And because I've been practicing for a while now, every time I think to myself, like, for example, in the shower this morning, there I was, locked in another imaginary fight or discussion with someone. I recognized what I was doing. I literally made myself stop, focus on the soap, which is a nice new soap I bought from a fancy store. And it worked for a moment there. I could feel myself just relax and go, oh, look, I'm in a lovely hot shower with a nice soap.
Yeah, well,
just a little moment like that can have an overall impact on me.
I used to, those imaginary conversations would happen when I woke up in the middle of the night, and if I was frustrated by somebody, perhaps at work, I'd, you know, almost draft a letter in my head. I've adopted a little saying now that just says, focus on the now and relax. And I say that to myself in bed, breathe in, focus on the now, and breathe out, just saying relax. And inevitably, I will go back to sleep. And, you know, I wake up 7 o'clock in the morning and I think to myself, boy, that strategy, that little tactic really works well.
Isn't that lovely? Because after a while of practicing like this, that part of your brain that's fretting and worrying does lose some of its power, because you're just seeing it for what it is, and it's disempowering it slightly. And
well,
it's really important.
It is about living in the now, I think. And I've been to mindfulness workshops, and people have said, well, when do you do your planning? And, you know, that's a dilemma that I had faced. And people say to me, well, if you live in the now, you know, you've got to be able to plan. Anyway, this mindfulness facilitator said, well, he allocates between 5:30 and 6:30 each day to do his planning. And I thought, well, that's a pretty sensible way of going about it.
Yeah, that sounds very good. If you can compartmentalise like that, fantastic.
Yeah. So you know, you did say that you were a bit stressed about this issue. You've got a lack of control. How do you think, you know, what tactics or strategies will you adopt to counter this stress?
I've got a few, really, that I'm applying. I mean, I'm really trying to work really hard on managing this one. One of the big sort of concepts of mindfulness is acceptance and not wasting energy wishing things were different than what they actually are. So I'm really just working on trying to accept this is the situation. Now how do I manage it rather than I wish it wasn't like this? That's just a waste of energy. So acceptance. I am, you know, it sounds cliche, but I'm also really trying to look for the positives in it, because there are positives in it. So that's a kind of a gratitude attitude, I suppose, but just trying to make sure that I keep reminding myself these are the positive things about what's happening, because that they are there, right? It's not all negative. Yeah, and also just telling myself, you know, the only constant is change. Nothing ever stays the same, ever. So, you know, this, in a sense, this is inevitable. Everything changes all the time. So all of those things to try and help myself roll with it rather than harden and tighten and fight it.
But, I mean, you've made a lot of changes, haven't you? I mean, there is a saying, if we always do what we've always done, we'll always get what we always got. And, you know, I think...
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I use it at my wellness classes that I facilitate. And I think it really underlines a critical message. So you've made a lot of changes, and it sounds as though, you know, you're on the road to, well, a self-discovery and practicing things a little bit differently.
Yeah, and also trying to forgive myself when I make mistakes, because I still do make mistakes and I get things wrong, and my interpretation isn't you know, necessarily the accurate view. And I'm so forgiveness as well, forgiving myself as well, and just accepting myself with my flaws is another big one. I mean, you know, it's hard being a human. It really is. We're all trying to do the best we can.
But, I mean, this approach of more mindfulness and your yoga practice, isn't this about being kinder to ourselves? I mean, being grateful as well?
Yes, absolutely it is. And just, yeah, and just looking for the good, positive things and having an understanding of what we need, you know, to balance our lives out.
You're with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And you're back on live again. Declan Curran with you. Sheldon Brown away having an operation today. I've got a song here now for you called The Nights from Avicii. And this multi-talented Swedish DJ, he passed away from natural causes on April the 20th at just 28 years of age. He had ongoing gallbladder and pancreatic problems, and he was hospitalised a number of times. For the sake of his physical and mental health, he stopped touring in 2016. He was the most successful songwriter in Sweden in 2015, and he claimed no less than six of the country's top 100 most popular songs of that year. In fact, he was the first artist to hit 200 music streams, 200 million. Something like that, anyway, on streaming on Spotify. So here's Avicii with The Nights, and you're listening to Take It From Us Mental Health Radio on 104.6 Planet FM.
Once upon a younger year, when all our shadows disappeared, the animals inside came out to play. Went face to face with all our fears, learned our lessons through the tears, made memories we knew would never fade. One day my father, he told me, son, don't let it slip away. He took me in his arms, I heard him say, when you get older, your wild heart will live for younger days. Think of me if ever you're afraid. He said one day you'll leave this world behind, so live a life you will remember. My father told me when I was just a child, these are the nights to never die. Can't put out, carve your name into those shining stars. He said, go venture far beyond the shores. Don't forsake this life of yours. I'll guide you home no matter where you are. One day my father, he told me, son, don't let it slip away. When I was just a kid, I heard him say, when you get older, you wild heart will live for younger days. Think of me if ever you're afraid. He said, one day behind, so live a life you will remember. My father told me when I was just a child, these are the nights to never die. My father told me.
That was The Nights from Avicii, and it was actually 200 million hits. How on earth I came up with two, I don't know. Anyway, in our second edited broadcast from last year, counselling psychologist Vicky Baird talks about burnout, especially among top professionals like doctors, surgeons, dentists, psychiatrists, lawyers, principals and teachers, and just how common it can be in these particular careers. Vicky's also suggesting how to safeguard against the personal trauma of burnout. Both of these interviews that we're playing today can be accessed after the show on planetaudio.org.nz/Take It From Us, along with the four most recent shows on Take It From Us.
Today we broadcast our second interview on burnout with counselling psychologist Vicky Baird. Last week Vicky shared her personal experience of burnout at a time in her life when she was transitioning from study into full-time work. Vicky described a personal trauma caused by a burnout while also helping our listeners understand what is burnout, how to know if you're on the road to burnout, and some of the differences between burnout and depression. Now, that broadcast was last Tuesday, and it's available on planetaudio.org.nz/takeitfromus or on our own radio website at takeitfromus.co.nz. Today we look at burnout, especially among top professionals like doctors and teachers, and just how common it can be in particular careers. We'll also suggest how you can safeguard against it. So welcome again, Vicky, to Take It From Us. The web is loaded with information about burnout among our top professionals, such as doctors, dentists, nurses, psychiatrists, lawyers, teachers and principals. I mean, it was really amazing to do some research on burnout and some statistics around it, and to realise that these career professionals are really affected by burnout. So we're going to talk about that today with Vicky. Let's recap a little bit. Your definition of burnout, Vicky?
Yes, Sheldon. So the definitions we used last week, so burnout can be described as a long-term negative affective state consisting of emotional, physical and mental exhaustion. So that's the key component. Burnout is not just physical exhaustion. It covers all bases. So the person feels depleted emotionally, mentally, physically. It's almost like their tank is empty. So they have nothing, they feel, everything feels overwhelming, they have nothing more to give. And even basic daily tasks of life can be so difficult for them. The other definition we referred to was erosion of the soul, which, you know, puts it in a more poetic way, I guess. But I guess that sums up what it feels like for the person.
Well, it's a pretty graphic sort of description, yeah, isn't it? Erosion of the soul. I think when our soul is eroded, we're really at breaking point.
Yeah, it really sums up that experience of burnout. Yeah.
So we've got in the research that I've done and shared with you, we've got a picture of top professionals such as doctors, dentists, nurses, psychiatrists, lawyers, teachers and principals. It probably should include public relations consultants as well, because I'm sure that as a public relations consultant many years ago, burnout was one of the things that I experienced. So what's the reality of burnout among such professionals?
Well, in particular, Sheldon, you mentioned all those professions, but I want to start, I guess, by highlighting how rife burnout is amongst doctors and health professionals in particular. So some of the statistics that we uncovered was that it's almost about half, even over half of doctors actually experiencing very high levels of stress and even burnout. And I find this, you know, quite concerning, I guess, particularly since doctors are in a profession where, you know, they're required to be physically, mentally and emotionally healthy, to have a full tank so that they can, you know, support other people when they're vulnerable. So this is quite a concerning figure, really.
So the survey was done by the Association of salaried medical specialists in New Zealand, and they say that as a group, doctors often neglect their own health, are not good at nurturing their family and social supports, and have few outlets for divesting themselves of the significant emotional load they carry from their work. I think another observation was that they're not particularly supportive of others. And I have a high-powered health professional who comes to stay via my Airbnb, and I was talking to him about burnout and how they're not particularly supportive. And he said, well, we don't exactly have the luxury of two-hour lunch breaks where we can sit with our colleagues who may be experiencing burnout or depression and put an arm around them and listen to them in a collegial, supportive way. He said, my lunch involves grabbing something from the cafe while I'm running from one patient to the other.
And I think that's so true, Sheldon. I mean, I actually do a bit of work at the Auckland University Medical School with the medical students. And time and time again, you know, I hear stories about this on clinical placements of just how pushed doctors and medical students are. You know, they're working long shifts, 12-hour shifts, over and above their time, often days on end without days off, and environments which, you know, are under-resourced, understaffed. You know, they're carrying a lot of responsibility. You're talking about life and death here, you're talking about human lives. And also the profession as well attracts, you know, health professions attract people who are naturally often highly driven, perfectionistic, compulsive, want to rescue everyone else, you know, really want care and support everyone else, but often at the expense that they neglect their own well-being. And I think this is the reality of the situation doctors are in. So I really think there's a big social component, there's a big societal component, and we have to look at the conditions that doctors are under as well.
Yeah. Do you think that we're talking about the average GP as well? I mean, a lot of this research that we've accessed on the internet appears to be public hospital specialists or public hospital doctors or junior doctors, and also dentists working in public hospitals. So all of them are saying what in terms of incidents of burnout, what sort of incidents of burnout are we, some of these, or our research indicating?
You know, you asked if it would be prevalent among GPs as well, and although we don't have statistics on GPs specifically, my impression that I get, you know, just through talking to medical students who work in this field, is with the GPs, it's quite unique. It really depends on the culture of the practice they work in, also where about, you know. Often, probably sadly to say it, in Auckland there's probably a lot more pressure than there is outside of Auckland. So in some of the more rural places, you know, that rate of burnout doesn't seem to be so high. But particularly, I think the main issue is public hospitals and public health settings. So, you know, likes of Auckland Hospital, North Shore Hospital, these big, busy, you know, publicly funded places, this seems to be where the...
And a lot of the frustration that appears from the research that we've identified is that their frustration often comes from the people that are running and managing these hospitals. And I also put this to this high-level professional, health professional who stays with me, and he said, well, you know, there are doctors that move into management as clinical representatives executives, but they're often caught up in the culture of administration and management, and really they seem to add to the frustration, he said, for doctors practicing, you know. So, yeah, it must be a tough environment, I think, and generally a high level of pressure and that sort of thing. The interesting thing is that I think in our survey, only 7% attributed their burnout to their interactions with patients. So that's a positive thing.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that highlights, you know, that highlights what we've just been talking about, because only 7% attributed to patients, which I'm quite relieved about. But nearly half of them said it was due to their work and frustrations with their work. So yeah, I think that says a lot about what we could do to help prevent burnout in our health.
What about what's happening in our schools with school principals and teachers and that sort of thing? What are the survey saying there?
Yeah, that was interesting as well. So school principals seem to be, I guess, the next people in line in terms of experiencing burnout. So their burnout figures for school principals were almost double what it is in the general population. And they also find that, so school principals, about 70% of them work more than 50 hours per week, and actually about a quarter of them work more than 60 hours a week during term time. So if you think like a 60 hour week is a normal thing for a quarter of our school principals, you know, that's concerning, you know, that leaves some questions there.
It's quoted here as saying principals experience high levels of emotional demands and emotional labour. What would you understand as emotional labour?
Again, it comes back to what we're talking about with doctors and health professionals. You know, they're responsible for, they're responsible for school children, you know, young children. They hold the responsibility of that entire school, whereas with school teachers, they may hold responsibility for one classroom, which is, you know, a high enough responsibility, but for the principal, you know, there's a lot falling on their heads in terms of if there's bullying at that school, or anything happens, you know, that could possibly be reported in the papers. There's a lot of responsibility on them, you know, to manage that. And also now, particularly in New Zealand, with the, you know, the school results, the figures, you know, there's a lot of pressure, I think, in principals to not only keep the children and the school culture safe, but also to be achieving, to be successful, you know, to be getting up to that decile one, decile two, or decile ten, sorry.
Yeah, decile, you know, one's down the bottom.
Yeah. You know, in New Zealand, we have some of the highest rates of domestic violence, you know.
Child
abuse, you know, and suicide as well, you know, and that's, you know, these are the realities that principals are facing every day.
Yeah, so the Principal's Health and Wellbeing Survey in 2016, I think it was commissioned by the Primary Sector Union, the New Zealand Educational Institute. It spoke to almost 400 principals across the country, and also to deputy and assistant principals. And as you say, it found that over 70% were working over 50 hours a week, and a quarter of them more than 60 hours, you know. And so I think it says here that this increases the sort of work-family conflict. I guess work-family is well, they're devoting so much time to their work that they're not able to devote much time to their families.
And that's it. I mean, if you have someone that's at work over 60 hours per week doing a lot of emotional labour, as we talked about, you know, that doesn't leave much time or energy for them to go back home and spend that time with their families.
on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us. I'm host Sheldon Brown. I'm talking to Vicky Beard, counselling psychologist, who's talking to us about burnout. It's the second show that we've done on burnout, and if you're interested in catching what Vicky said about burnout in the first show, you can go to planetaudio.org.nz/Take It From Us or our own Take It From Us website, which is www.takeitfromus.co.nz.
We're just talking about that in terms of the emotional labour they put into being responsible and caring for the children and dealing with the family issues as well as the school issues.
Yeah, so this Principal's Health and Wellbeing Survey that was done last year says that stress was reported at 1.8 times the general population. This is among principals. And problems sleeping reported at almost two and a half times higher. Women in particular reported significantly higher rates of burnout and problems sleeping than their male counterparts. So there's that theme coming through again, Vicky, that women seem to be more vulnerable, more susceptible to burnout.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
Noted that most principals and school teachers had a healthy alcohol intake and did not take to the bottle to manage stress. I'm not sure whether that's the case with another profession that we can turn to, and that's lawyers. Is there much survey or research onto burnout among lawyers in New Zealand?
Not particularly in New Zealand, it seems. We did get some statistics from the US that said that lawyers are actually over 3.5 times more likely to suffer from depression than non-lawyers. So 3 times more likely is a pretty significant figure. I would suspect that there might be some similar figures in New Zealand, or certainly there might be higher rates of depression and burnout in New Zealand. So although we didn't find any specific statistics from New Zealand, what we did notice was that, you know, the Law Society does dedicate quite a significant part of its website to information about depression and burnout. I find this a bit confronting because, you know, to say the solution is simple is actually not true. You know, I think what we're looking at is that it's actually quite complex. if the solution was simple, then, you know, we wouldn't be having these burnout figures. So, yeah, hopefully we can talk a bit more about that and we can give you guys some tips on how to manage your well-being. Because we're dealing with personality components of people, you know, we're dealing with social work pressure, work cultures, which are not often quite not supportive. So, yeah, it's a whole complex array of things, and particularly that, you know, that thing that we've mentioned about not being able to say no, you know. There's a real reason for that, why people have that, and it's often related to, you know, quite ingrained and deep past experiences. So it takes a bit of work, you know, to actually learn to say no sometimes.
Well, yeah. I mean, isn't, you know, not saying no, that's a rather stumbling way to put it, but I think it we want to please people. I'm sure that I don't say no because I want to please people. I want to be seen to be willing to do work, willing to help people, willing to help out, I guess. You know, I think we worry about the repercussions of saying no. That we may be seen as somebody who's not cooperative, who's not part of the team, who isn't prepared to go that extra mile. And so many of us these days, I think, working in health and mental health, are being asked to do more for less money, or at least to the same amount of money.
Yeah, and that's it, you know. And So there's the personal component and that social component, you know. Often it's not just even about people pleasing, but it's, you know, issues like, if I say no, is this going to affect my job? Is this going to affect my future? You know, and I think that's the real issues that are going on for a lot of New Zealanders. You know, and we've highlighted different health professions. Like, I'll give you an example from, say, from doctors, like, for instance, surgeons. You know, you say, okay, just say no, don't work overtime. But if you're in a situation where you're a group, you're a member of a team in an operating theatre, there's complications, you've already done a 12-hour shift, those complications take you overtime, you still have another person to operate on in your surgical list for that day. Your decision to say no, to go home, means that someone's surgery might be held back for weeks or months. You know, that's a real kind of, you know, just to highlight, that's the real choices that doctors have to make, you know.
I mean, that's very extreme. Very graphic. Well, I wonder if it is that extreme, actually. I think that's a very real example of why surgeons, doctors, health teams are working such long hours.
Yeah, that's it. You know, if someone calls in sick, you know, and in the next shift, then it falls on those people in that shift. Like, do we stay on? That could make a difference to life or death for patients, you know. So,
yes. And that's the business they're in, isn't it? Caring for people, trying to get them well again. Mm. I guess the other thing about saying no is that there's a pretty good chance that one of your colleagues are going to be called in to do the job. And if they do a very spectacular job or a very effective job, then, you know, they're shining when you're sitting in the shadows.
And that's it. Yeah, and that's another good point. And actually, it reminds me of one of the issues I had when I was experiencing burnout. You know, it was slightly different from that, but again, on the same line, I knew if I called in sick, you know, that would put pressure on my colleagues, you know, who I also was seeing were experiencing effects of burnout and stress, you know. So I was also aware of that, like, yeah, I'm feeling burned out, I can call in sick, but how is this going to impact my colleagues? You know, how much more stressed will that make them? So it's really complex.
What else, what are some of the other things that we can do to counter burnout?
So again, I guess around that topic of healthy boundaries, which is what saying no is about, you know, it's things like, you know, people can do other things, like, for instance, leaving work at work, you know, having some kind of ritual or some kind of process that you go through when you leave work. It might be leaving your files or, you know, switching your phone off or whatever it is, leaving it at the door. You know, it might even be taking a few deep breaths as you leave, so you can emotionally, you know, move from one place into the next, you know, from work to back home. So those little things we can do. Also taking a bit of me time every day, you know. So, yeah, you might be working in a stressful environment. It might be difficult at times to say no to overtime. But one of the things you might want to introduce is 5 minutes, you know, 5 minutes earlier in the morning to just have your cup of tea or coffee, have that quiet time. You know, taking those micro breaks can make a big difference.
Taking a pause or doing a little bit of mindfulness early in the morning. I mean, it's a discipline that I've adopted.
And the next item we had was exercise as well. So even when we're really busy, really full, thinking about what kind of exercise we can do, and that doesn't need to be going out for an hour at the gym. It might be something like taking a 10-minute walk in your lunch break, you know, or just getting outside, walking around. It might just be something like parking your car a bit further away and taking that extra 5-10 minutes to walk to work.
Well, that's a reality in Auckland anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
trying to find a car park anywhere close to where you're going.
Yeah, so making it work for you. So not stressing yourself out, but introducing small little bits of exercise, maybe even 5 minutes of yoga in the morning. So that's one thing. Another thing is, you know, becoming expert at relaxing. You know, schedule in pleasurable activities. You know, and again, you don't need to stress yourself out, but small pleasurable activities. It might just be going for that after work drink with your colleagues once a week for a couple of hours. It might be just meeting a friend for a coffee. Just a small thing can make a big difference.
And taking us out to our Joe Cocker theme today is a track from October 1991. It peaked at number 2 on the US charts. Here's Enya singing Caribbean Blue. Catch you again next Tuesday at 12:30 right here for Take It From Us Mental Health Radio, 104.6 Planet FM. Sheldon should be back in the hot seat by then. Take care, have a great week. Thanks for listening.